Women and their doctors have become more open about discussing menopause. But what about perimenopause, that transitional phase that can last for years? This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Joining me now to discuss perimenopause and the latest on hormone replacement therapy are Ms. Medicine founder and past president of the Menopause Society, Dr. Lisa Larkin. Welcome back, Dr. Larkin.
Thank you so much for having me.
And TriHealth gynecologist and obstetrician, Dr. Betsy Leroy. Thanks for being here, Dr. Leroy.
Thank you so much.
It's great to have you both in the studio. Dr. Larkin, what is perimenopause and how different is it from menopause?
So perimenopause is the period of time prior to menopause when women's ovaries are just having those early changes. The ovaries are aging and women, their fertility starts to decline. It's a period of time where hormone production becomes inconsistent. And women will notice this very early. If you talk to a woman, she can tell you she's entering perimenopause. Her cycles will become irregular. She will often have, for the first time, new symptoms. It can be worse PMS, heavier bleeding, lighter bleeding, intermittent hot flashes. She also may notice a change in her libido and sexual function. She may notice some weight gain, starting with some sleep disturbances, all of the things that women notice very quickly that they're starting to age. And this correlates with fertility declining. And it's a bumpy road for women. Their hormones are erratic during this period of time, but they haven't completely stopped their periods yet.
I've been on that road, and bumpy is a very kind way to describe it, Dr. Larkin. Dr. Leroy, what's the typical age for perimenopause? Does it differ for women who have had children and women who haven't had children?
So much like how first periods will be varied when an individual will have those, same thing with women in perimenopause. Some women, I'd say about 80%, do experience symptoms. About 20% don't experience symptoms during this time frame. So some will sail through these years without any complications or any concerns, but the majority are on that roller coaster that we were just talking about. And I'd say the average age would be somewhere around 40 to 45. We'll start to see some perimenopausal symptoms, but these will linger 3 to 7 years, and in some cases transition straight into the menopause transitional time or phase of life, and that brings on a whole other host of issues. Really, when it comes to previous parity or whether or not they've had children, it's not as indicative as actually even just inquiring with your own mother, older siblings, seeing when they experience symptoms. Sometimes that'll give you a better clue when you might be going through that process as well.
Hmm. Dr. Larkin, you talked about some of the symptoms. What are the most common symptoms, and how much can they interfere with somebody's day-to-day life?
Right. Well, first of all, the perimenopause is broken down into early perimenopause and late perimenopause, and the symptoms are really different. As you're getting to the late perimenopause, this is when we start seeing the more classic symptoms of estrogen deficiency when you're having hot flashes and night sweats and vaginal dryness. The early perimenopause, and this, again, typically is 6 years before the final menstrual period, but again, it's very variable, as Dr. Leroy said. But the early phase is typically menstrual irregularity, differences in bleeding pattern, changes in cycle length. Many women early can miss a period or two, then have regular cycles again. And it's more subtle symptoms, right? So this can be weight gain, change in libido, just noticing more fatigue, sleep disturbances. And what I really say, there's a lot of emphasis these days I see on social media about whether or not this is a time when you can have your blood tested to determine whether or not you're in perimenopause. And I can get into all kinds of pitfalls with doing that. But what I really say is a woman can tell you if she's in perimenopause. Talking to your patient is the most important thing, really having an ear and listening, because women know their bodies and they will tell you that they're starting to experience symptoms. And for the majority of women, again, not 100% as Dr. Leroy said, but women notice aging and notice changing that's happening related to their ovarian function declining.
I've never heard of a blood test. There's a blood test that
Yes. Well, so we don't, you know, guidelines do not suggest that the vast majority of women need blood tests, but there is some over-the-counter testing now that's available. A lot of people are in many clinics, hormone centers, functional medicine clinics are doing a lot of battery of testing of hormone levels. The problem in the perimenopause is that, as I mentioned, hormone production is inconsistent. And so just like I would say a blood sugar can be normal, you know, first thing in the morning, and then you have a huge meal and you may see elevations, it can change minute to minute. The same thing is true in the perimenopause with hormone levels, right? So when you're measuring them at one point in time, it can give you misinformation, meaning at one moment in time in the perimenopause, it might suggest that you're menopausal when in fact you're not, because the definition of menopause is no menstrual bleeding for 12 months. It's not a blood test. Or it can tell you, and I see this many times for patients coming in to see me in practice, is that they're told by their doctor that their hormone levels are normal, that they cannot be in perimenopause. And that's inaccurate as well. And so it goes back to, it's a clinical diagnosis, really, with talking to the patient sitting in front of you, which is a mixture of changes in their menstrual cycles and bleeding patterns, and then the other symptoms that I mentioned.
Hmm. We're talking about perimenopause. We're going to talk about also hormone replacement therapy and the questions women should be asking their doctors. Do you have questions or comments? Give us a call at 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. So Dr. Leroy, it sounds like most women get that feeling. They kind of know that their body's changing and what's going on. But how much can those early changes interfere with day-to-day life? I mean, I guess it depends on how severe those symptoms are.
I think we're having conversations now that recognize these perimenopausal or early changes are really affecting, about, like I said before, about 80% of women, where they start to notice a decline in their overall mood function, maybe how their behavioral responses are, fatigue secondary to poor sleep quality. And that, as we know, rolls into so many functions that we have. And then you add on top of that, perhaps changes in relationship status, intimacy. You have a bad cycle, menstrual cycle, that's going to throw you off as well. So I think it really impacts the quality of life in this age group. In prior generations, I think the conversations weren't as fluid. We weren't talking about this as much, or we were, when I say we, I mean the medical establishment, were kind of brushing these things off as normal aging or get over it or this is natural. And now we kind of recognize that this opens up an opportunity to have conversations where we can intervene or at least even validate what they're going through to help them through this time frame.
Why do you think that changed? And I'm going to ask perhaps a sexist question. Could it be because more women are practicing medicine now and going through this themselves, more aware?
I think Lisa can add to this because she has been involved with the Menopause Society for decades. But I think there's been an overall general awareness, and whether that be information or misinformation that's available through social media. People are talking about reproductive care a lot more when it comes to these. I know women come to me saying that this is the conversation at book club, at the Mahjong table, that this is what individuals are talking about. And whether it be through social media forums or through the people that they trust, I think the conversation has been out there more in the forefront. Whereas we used to kind of brush it off or consider it the change, some sort of quiet little, you know, individualized suffering you had to do in the corner by yourself. The conversation has been allowed to be had now. I won't comment if it's a sexist thing or not. I think OBGYN has had a lot of women involved in this field for a number of years, so I'm not sure that relays with that. But I just think the overall ability for us to be vulnerable and to talk more amongst each other, and now that more practitioners are also bringing up the conversation with our patients, the Menopause Society, which I'm a member of as well, has exponentially grown in the last several years. And so that also dominoes into providers being able to initiate these conversations with their patients who might otherwise not feel like they have a safe place to talk.
So Dr. Larkin, for women who are experiencing these early perimenopausal symptoms, do you ever prescribe hormone replacement therapy? When does that conversation start?
So this is a great conversation. So let me just start by saying that from, I'm an internist, right? Not OBGYN, who's been working in the menopause space for a long time. And perimenopause, I would argue, is the most important time that women really need high quality, good medical care, because it's a time of abrupt physiologic change that has impact for all of the things that happen next in terms of healthy aging and, you know, this new buzzword that we want to have a long health span. So finally, there really is a lot of interest into really women being proactive and doctors understanding that this is a really important time to try to discuss how should we be managing perimenopause symptoms now. And there's a couple different approaches, but what really starts with is the patient in front of me and what her primary symptoms are and what we're trying to address. Now, the first and foremost thing is to remember that even though I told you that fertility declines in the perimenopause, it's not gone. So we always have to remember that we need to be mindful of needing contraception because unplanned pregnancies absolutely happen. So in the perimenopause, and I will tell you, I use a lot of oral contraceptives in the perimenopause, and they can be incredibly effective. And the difference between oral contraceptives, and there's a lot of differences, but I'll try to simplify this. Oral contraceptives and hormone replacement therapy, and I would tell you our preferred term is menopausal hormone therapy, but we can get into that too. Continuous oral contraceptives or oral contraceptives work by suppressing ovarian function. So I told you that they, during this period of time, you have really inconsistent hormone swings. And so by suppressing ovulation and suppressing the ovaries and giving even doses of hormones back, women will have much improved bleeding patterns, and a lot of their symptoms in terms of this, you know, worse PMS, sleep disturbance, intermittent hot flashes, mood disturbance can be much improved by oral contraceptives. And so that often is a mainstay, and it also provides pregnancy protection. Now, again, there's a lot of discussion about using menopausal hormone therapy or hormone replacement therapy during the perimenopause. And I will tell you, among us, who's people who are working in the space, it's a little bit controversial about whether or not this is a good thing or a bad thing. I can tell you there is a place for it, but the problem with menopausal hormone therapy at this phase, before the ovaries have completely quit, is that you're not giving enough hormones to suppress ovulation. And so you may still have the swings that you're experiencing without having kind of the evening out of hormones. You also, by giving menopausal hormone therapy, may actually make the dysfunctional bleeding pattern worse. And so although there is a role sometimes in specific patients that are having specific symptoms, I typically in the perimenopause, if you put, you know, 10 patients in front of me, probably 8 of them I'm using continuous oral contraceptives on, and I'm using menopausal hormone therapy or hormone replacement therapy in the other 2. But it's, again, very patient dependent.
When you talk about continuous oral contraception, do you mean no week off?
Correct.
For a menstrual
Correct.
Cycle?
No okay. week off. Because one of the other things, and again, as the internist that I see very commonly, is, you know, migraines become often a much bigger problem for women in the perimenopause. And really what we know is it's the change in hormone levels that is often the trigger for the migraine. And so, again, even during this period of time, the PMS can be much worse because of the hormone swings. Continuous contraceptives without that placebo week can be very, very effective.
And I guess it doesn't even have to be oral contraceptives, right, Dr. Laura?
Absolutely. There are half a dozen different modalities we can do to suppress that menstrual cycle and those hormonal fluctuations. Progestin IUDs are very helpful, at least when it comes to the problematic cycles. We have combined estrogen and progestin rings. There are patches. There are a number of things that can be done during this time frame. And might I also add, it's safe to not have a period. So I think there's been a lore that I hear from patients all the time that it's not clean or it's not safe to not to go a certain amount of time frame without a period. Under these conditions where you're on a prescribed medication that is intended to even out those swings, it is very safe. And actually, that's the ideal goal, is to not have a cycle or a period during this time frame.
Okay. Well, we will continue our conversation after a short break. And later in the program, 40 years of the Duncanson Artist in Residence program with 3 of the people who've been honored. This is Cincinnati Edition. You're listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're continuing our conversation about perimenopause, hormone replacement therapy, and what women should be asking their doctors. My guests are TriHealth gynecologist and obstetrician, Dr. Betsy Leroy, and Ms. Medicine founder, Dr. Lisa Larkin. You can join the conversation. Just call 513-419-7100, or you can email talk at WVXU.com. www.perimenopause.org. Dr. Larkin, it seems like there's a generation of women, I'm thinking of women my late mother's age in their 70s perhaps, who were prescribed hormone replacement therapy pretty routinely. That stopped after a study that has since been kind of called into question. I know that's a complicated history, but can you briefly walk us through that?
Yes, absolutely. So I would tell you that my professional career has been defined by the winding road of menopausal hormone therapy. And so I practiced for 10 years prior to the WHI, which is the study that you're talking about that came out in 2002. And for those 10 years, based on data we had, we believed that giving hormone replacement therapy was the right thing to do for almost all women because we believed we were decreasing cardiovascular disease. We weren't sure what was happening with breast cancer, but the majority of women die of cardiovascular disease, so we were prescribing it, and I was prescribing it. 2002, I remember exactly where I was standing when the first arm of the WHI data came out, and it was all over the news media, and truthfully, I was really felt very personally attacked by some of the news media that was calling we doctors willy-nilly for prescribing hormone therapy to women. And it was really, again, remember in medicine and in science, data evolves and things changed. And we had been using data that was not randomized clinical trials. It was observational data. And then we have the WHI, which is a randomized controlled trial, large one, that showed that breast cancer risk increased, cardiovascular disease increased, stroke increased, clot increased. And it was all over the news media, and women stopped taking their hormones almost instantaneously. We saw this in the number of prescriptions. And the bigger thing I would argue is that physicians stopped prescribing it. In Cincinnati, I was one of the few people at the time that was still trying to talk women into taking hormone therapy for appropriate reasons. But we also stopped educating doctors about menopause. And so we've now gone fast forward, 20 plus years, and we have now 20 plus years of doctors who've finished training who really have limited knowledge of menopausal hormone therapy and the study, and really still all have heard this messaging about how scary and terrible it is. And I would argue that the mistake that you highlight is that the risks really were overblown in the way that the data was presented. It's really important data, but the risks were magnified for everyone, doctors and patients. And the benefits of hormone therapy were completely forgotten. And there's a lot of benefits to hormone therapy. And so finally, we've reached a place now. And I can tell you, being in the Menopause Society for all these years, and finally, as Dr. LaRoy said, the membership increasing and there's interest in menopause, we've been screaming this from the rooftops for the last 25 years that really the data was presented in a way where it was causing harm because too few women were being offered menopausal hormone therapy. And finally, that's really changing, thanks really to, I think, celebrities hitting menopause and the social media really being a platform to get the message out. And now we're really thinking about hormone therapy at midlife in a completely different way, which I think is very, very positive.
So, Dr. LaRoy, what are the risks associated with menopausal hormone therapy? And are there risks associated with not taking these hormones and just kind of gutting it out with the symptoms so many women have?
First off, I think it's important to address why we start hormone therapy, menopausal hormone therapy. And there's about three clear-cut reasons that the Menopause Society and those of us in the weeds endorse. One would be to help with hot flashes, night sweats, what we call vasomotor symptoms and the sleep disruptions from that. Secondly would be those individuals who are having vulvar or vaginal concerns, chronic UTIs from the hypoestrogenic state. And finally would be for osteoporosis prevention. And that's not a sexy topic that a lot of people really focus on when they come in to see me in the office. They really are worried more about the first two considerations. But osteoporosis prevention is a huge tenet of hormone therapy that doesn't get a lot of attention and I think should be discussed. So we have to look at the patient's concerns and their questions, and we have to designate if the patient is at risk for being on the hormone therapy, meaning if they have an underlying cardiovascular complication, if they have an underlying estrogen sensitive cancer. That's another reason they should not be on hormone therapy. And then we also have to individualize. There are some individuals who have maybe moderate risk cardiovascular history, and we can talk to them about where their risks and where their benefits are on that. It is you know, integral that whatever provider a patient talks to, that they really sit down and calculate their breast risk, their cardiovascular risk. They look at their brain history. They look at risk. They look at their family history of bone relations, bone issues and relations to them. And so I think when you take that whole picture in, you can kind of individualize, is this therapy going to be something good for you? Or is this something that we may think that we can treat in other ways?
Dr. Larkin, testosterone has recently come up in discussions about menopause. Can you talk about how it's being used and whether that's ever something you recommend?
Well, so let me add a little bit more to what Dr. Leroy just said, because 100% agree with everything that she said. And what I am seeing in practice now in exponential numbers is related to what's out there on social media now, which is that really menopausal hormone therapy and GLP-1 medications are thrown in there. And menopausal hormone therapy with the addition of testosterone is really on this path of longevity. And these are longevity medicines. And the messaging is really that all women should be on menopausal hormone therapy, including testosterone. And I would tell you that guidelines don't support that. There really are guidelines that do not support menopausal hormone therapy across the board for primary prevention. Now, a lot of people on social media can pick at that data. We can talk about that for hours and hours and hours. But at least at this moment, guidelines don't support that. Now, again, this goes back to in younger women close to menopause, there are lots of benefits of menopausal hormone therapy, and I prescribe it all the time. But I'm seeing now women who are at high risk or who are older, who have cardiovascular risk factors, coming in because of what they're hearing on social media, afraid that they missed the opportunity for hormone therapy and wanting to take it. So your question was about testosterone. So first of all, testosterone is a really important hormone in women, and it has not gotten the attention it has deserved for years. You know, women's health hasn't gotten the attention it deserves. With that said, the data about testosterone is specifically for a condition called hypoactive sexual desire disorder, that really is where we have data in the late perimenopause and the early menopause, where, again, giving physiologic dosing of testosterone to women may be very helpful for sexual function. And I prescribe it for that reason in that way. What you're seeing all over social media and what I'm seeing in the Cincinnati community, frankly, is a lot of use of testosterone for different reasons, for longevity, for muscle preservation, and in doses that I would tell you are not appropriate for women. I also am seeing a lot of side effects related to supraphysiologic, too high dosing of testosterone that women are being given. And so this is an area.
Are these med spas that they're prescribing these?
And right. And again, you know, there certainly is a lot of discussion about this topic on social media, and the big sexual medicine annual meeting is just about to happen. Unfortunately, I can't go this year. But there is continued discussion about whether or not the data supports use for other reasons, like preservation of lean muscle mass, and whether or not it should be standard part of menopausal hormone therapy. I personally do not believe that we are there yet with the data. And so again, for me in practice, I'm using it for very specific reasons, hypoactive sexual desire disorder, and using it in appropriately aged women in appropriate doses.
So is this safe?
So it's safe, but you have to have it at the right dose. And unfortunately, a lot of the providers in the community are giving it at too high of doses that result in an entire sequela of side effects. We'll see facial hair develop, acne. We'll see vulvar changes, voice deepening. And all of these changes, at least those physiologic ones, are irreversible in some cases. Can I also add that, you know, libido, low libido is probably up there with weight gain, one of the biggest complaints that I hear in the office, and it's a very nuanced topic. And I can medicate easier out of a hot flash and help someone with that or a sleep issue. Libido is layered with 3 months or 35 years of a relationship, the stressors of everyday life, how that individual feels about herself or how she is in the relationship, how the other individual is playing in the relationship. And so I don't find testosterone therapy to be a panacea at all when it comes to those individuals with low libido.
No, I want to really echo that. Because 100% agree. You asked me specifically about testosterone. I will just make two quick points, if it's okay, which is testosterone begins to decline in women in the mid to late 30s. Testosterone doesn't abruptly decline like estrogen does at menopause. And so women will have a gradual decline in their testosterone level prior to menopause. And again, just like Dr. Leroy said, women's sexual health is complicated, and it does not correlate directly with testosterone in many, or I would say most women. It is multifactorial. And so testosterone is not a perfect panacea, but again, that is the indication where there are guidelines for us for using it.
And with testosterone, it is safe if we keep it within the right numbers. So that's the other thing. We have to routinely check those labs and make sure that we're giving a safe physiologic dose.
Make sure you talk to your doctor. I've been talking with Ms. Medicine founder, Dr. Lisa Larkin, and TriHealth gynecologist and obstetrician, Dr. Betsy Leroy. Thank you both so much for your time today. Up next, we discuss 40 years of the Duncanson Artist in Residence Program with some of the people who've been honored. This is Cincinnati Edition.